WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. On Thursday, the Justice Department released a report that concluded private prisons are less safe than those run by the government. Consequently, the department said it would begin the process of ending its use of private prisons. Now, media outlets such as Mother Jones and The Nation have previously published investigations that said the same thing, that helped lead to the Justice Department's decision the other day. Others do question DOJ's study. Here to discuss the report and the significance of the Justice Department walking away from private prisons is Julika Lantigua-Williams, staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers criminal justice. Welcome to WNYC, Julika. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
For context, to start out, how large is the private prison industry in the United States, and how many private prisons are there?
So there are private prisons, federal prisons, right? Because they're used by states also. So at the federal level, we contract with prisons in 8 states, California, Connecticut, Texas. There's quite a few of them. Their population is about 22,000 right now of an estimated 193,000 federal inmates in custody.
And most of the people incarcerated in America are housed in state prisons. Most crimes, most people know, are, you know, crimes against the state of New York, the state of New Jersey, the state of Connecticut, rather than against the U.S. government. So the DOJ's decision doesn't apply to state prisons. There's still going to be tons of private prison cells and beds all over the country. But what kinds of private prisons tend to be federal?
So in 1997, the Bureau of the Federal Bureau of Prisons actually contracted private prisons specifically to house low-security alien adult males, right? And specifically to house people who had less than 7.5 years to serve. So they delineated a very specific population, low-risk population. These are not people who had committed, you know, capital murder, things like that. These were people who were considered less of a security threat, and therefore they were basically farmed off to these private corporations. So that was about 10 years ago.
And why did the DOJ decide no longer to use private prisons or to start phasing them out?
Well, I think overall it's part of a broader strategy, what people call the decarceration of the United States, especially at the federal government. I think that the federal government recognizes, and many, many studies have shown, you know, really concrete evidence that putting people in jail really has a very little deterrent effect on crime. It has almost zero value in terms of rehabilitation on an ongoing basis. And more significantly, it leaves people with essentially a lifelong sentence. Your readers might not be aware of this, but 70 million Americans have a criminal record. 70 million Americans. And so that's a huge swath of the population. And so what happens is that having a criminal record creates barriers to entry in the economy. It's really hard to get a job. It creates barriers to entry in home ownership, in higher education. And so I think the White House is cognizant of the multiple layers of impact that having a criminal record can have on someone. And they're trying to approach it from multiple angles at this point. The Department of Education recently announced an effort to work with colleges to eliminate the use of criminal backgrounds in, you know, deciding whether or not to give someone admissions into a college. So that was another really good mm-hmm. step. Just on Friday, they provided an amicus brief in an appeals court, basically saying that indigent folks, people who are poor, who are destitute, who are put in jail, cannot be held if they're unable to pay bail. So that's a really big step for the administration to take, to say, listen, we are advocating and we are supporting the idea that it is unconstitutional, right? It goes against our core beliefs as Americans that if you cannot pay bail, you should be held in jail. And bail is a significant, it has what I call like a legal domino effect, right? So a professor at UPenn did a study recently in which she showed that people who cannot make bail get significantly harsher sentences. They plea to harsher crimes in some instances that they might not have even committed. They lose their jobs. They lose their housings. In some instances, they've lost custody of their children, all because they were not able to make a 10% deposit on their bail, which is what's required mm-hmm. In Philadelphia. So I think there's a confluence of things now happening that are making people really aware of how layered and how web-like the criminal justice system can be for an individual, especially an indigent individual.
That's a really good description of the multifaceted attempt by the Obama administration to pull back on mass incarceration, figuring out how much of it is really unnecessary, and pulling back from those aspects of mass incarceration in the United States. And on the private prisons piece, because, of course, if somebody's going to be incarcerated, that decision has already been made. And then whether they're in a public prison or a private prison is kind of, its own separate question in a way. The Deputy Attorney General, Sally Yates, said in a statement the other day, quote, "They simply do not provide the same level of correctional services, programs, and resources. They do not save substantially on costs. And as noted in a recent report by the Department's Office of Inspector General, they do not maintain the same level of safety and security." I guess this was always the problem, even intuitively, from the start of the private prison era a few decades ago, that, oh, my goodness, here's going to be a company that's trying to make money by running prisons, not a public agency that's accountable in our democracy, but a private company out to make money by incarcerating people. Of course, they're going to not provide for the inmates as well. And of course, they're going to skimp on things and overlook things if it hampers the bottom line. Is that basically what the Department of Justice has finally concluded?
I think so. I mean, I think it's the old adage of if you want something right, you've got to do it yourself, right? A lot of us grow up having our parents tell us that. And I think it's a situation of realizing that, yeah, if we want to have continuity, if we want to have uniformity, if we want to have results that really indicate that our money was well spent, then we've got to do it ourselves. But more importantly, I think in general, the administration is moving away from trying to grow the federal prison population, which, you know, is a stark difference from what the policy was in the 1990s and early aughts. I think right now they're trying to decrease the rolls as expediently as possible. And for example, I expect there to be quite a few more commutations coming in the next few months, again, with the goal in mind of overall decreasing significantly the prison population.
Mm-hmm. Right. So if you don't need more beds, then you don't need as much to figure out how to build more beds, therefore maybe contract with private companies to construct these prisons and then run them. As we talk about the Department of Justice announcement on Thursday to phase out the use of private prisons by the federal government, talking about it with Julika Lantigua-Williams, staff writer at The Atlantic, I wonder in the few minutes we have remaining for this whether anybody listening has had experience with any aspect of the private prison industry. Have you worked maybe as a corrections officer or anything? Have you been incarcerated in a private prison? I wonder if anybody's listening who's worked as a correction officer, maybe in both private and public, and want to compare them or anything else that would be really relevant. in the next couple of minutes at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. There is criticism of the Justice Department's report and conclusion. Paul Barrett, for example, reported on this for Bloomberg. He wrote, the report didn't control for critical variables such as the makeup of prison populations and facility locations. Many contract prison populations are dominated by criminal aliens serving sentences before they're deported, often back to Mexico or Central America. Those facilities are more difficult to manage and more prone to violence because of the entrenched presence of gangs based in Latin American nations. These populations in the Bureau of Prisons-run prisons tend to be more heterogeneous and, if not easy to keep in line, certainly easier to manage than populations characterized by foreign gang rivalries. Do you understand the criticism that they're getting at, and has DOJ responded?
I don't think DOJ has responded, and I definitely understand the criticism, but I think, way before the Crime Act, way before BOP started engaging with private prisons, there were factions that formed within prisons. There were many times that were based on ethnicities, many times that were based on gang affiliation, but this goes back, 100 years to when the system was initially put in place. I mean, what people, I think, fail to understand is that prison is its own ecosystem, and it has its own hierarchies, and people in there tend to sort of shapeshift in their identity based on necessity, based on survival. And so though, because private prisons hold criminal adult males who are non-Americans, it's the same dynamic. If you go to a maximum federal security prison, you'll find that the inmates have created their own subcultures and their own subgroups, and that the power dynamics are determined by those affiliations. And so it's a question of, can the private prisons understand and secure the populations that they have contracted to warehouse? And if they can't, then how can they improve on that? And it seems like the DOJ has determined that they're not able to improve on it, and that the cost effectiveness is also not there. I mean, we have to recognize that the Bureau of Prisons is 25% of the annual budget for the DOJ.
Let's take a couple of calls.
Huge.
Because we are getting what looks like some interesting personal experience calls coming in. Ellie in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ellie. Thanks for calling.
Hi, no problem. I was a nurse with the Department of Justice at FCI Fort Dix in New Jersey, and then I had to moonlight, which is a nursing term, spend a couple of days sometimes covering actually in Dallas at one of the private prisons because they had a really hard time staffing medical personnel.
Thank you very much. Can you make any conclusion from that about whether, does this make you happy that the Department of Justice is going to phase out the use of private prisons?
Definitely. I found, especially amongst medical personnel in the Department of Justice, I'm not going to pretend it was great medically working there, but compared to the detention center that was contracted that I worked in, they just had a very, very hard time keeping staff members and keeping staff members happy. And really a hard, when you have a hard time keeping good nursing staff, it's hard to give good nursing care. So I think that this is, and I hope that ICE follows suit. I hope that other groups within the federal government follow suit.
Thank you very much, Ellie. Here might be a similar story about healthcare in the private sector in prison on Long Island from Miriam calling from Nassau County. Hi, Miriam.
Brian, I personally have not had any. I've not had any personal experience with the prison system, but our neighboring Nassau County has the Nassau County Jail, which is low-level offenders, short-term, contracted out several years ago their health care, not the entire facility, but just their health care, to Armor Health, and they had 5 deaths in the past year and a half, most of them under suspicious or wrongful circumstances. And this is going to cost the county, aside from the human aspect, it's going to cost the county much, much more in wrongful death lawsuits than they ever could have saved.
And you're saying this might be because, of course, we can't substantiate whether, these were wrongful deaths here in a conversation, but are you saying these may have allegedly become bad because the provider was not a public health care provider as opposed to a private health care provider? Is that what you're saying?
In several of the cases, it has been substantiated that there was neglect.
All right. Thank you very much. Chi in Atlanta. You're on WNYC. Hello from New York, Chi. Thanks for calling us.
Hey, how you doing, Brian? I'm a former New York resident, listen to your show a lot, and just trying to share my experience. I've just recently got out of the GEO Group facility down here, and just want to inform your listeners, it is totally horrible. And it's definitely horrible for a prisoner like me. There's no educational programs, basically nothing to do. They put you in front of a TV. As far as the healthcare aspect, it is totally terrible. I had a condition where I was actually bleeding. I don't want to get too graphic from my stomach. And basically, it was like a yo-yo. I was woken up 5 in the morning, promised to go to a nurse. When I get there, she has an attitude. You can see that whole motive is just for profit. And for a lot of your listeners who are concerned about taxes, the individuals that ICE brings there, I mean, it's just a total waste of money. You have grown gentlemen who are 40 and 50 who basically want to be deported. They don't learn any English. They sit in front of the TV all day in front of Univision. There's basically nothing to do. It just creates an environment where people fight and do illicit things. So we just encourage your listeners that, you know, call their senator or whatever they can do, because it's just a horrible situation.
Gee, I'm sorry for what you went through. Thank you for calling us and sharing it. Susan in Caldwell, you're on WNYC. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just calling as an attorney who goes and visits her clients in some of these jails. The one that comes to mind specifically is there was one in Elizabeth that houses immigration detention individuals,
right,
that are held there pending their cases or on bond. And it's just my experience and my colleague's experience that I've spoken to is that every time you go to the jail, it's like they're just very, very poorly trained. It's like the procedure changes every other day. Sometimes a business card is okay for ID. Sometimes it's just a mess.
Different than what you would find in a publicly run prison?
Yeah, right, exactly. Because I would go in the same area. I would go visit immigration clients in Essex County Jail, for example, in Newark, and the guys would know me. How you doing? It's the same people, and there seems to be more of retention, obviously, in the corrections facility, and they know what's going on, where to go, where to send me, versus in the other one, it's like, oh, I need your ID. No, this is not a good enough ID. I said, well, it was good enough last time I came.
Right.
But what about this time? And they're like, oh, well, were you here before? Oh, I don't see you in the system. And it's like, what is going on? And it's just very, very frustrating. I've had times where I had to, like, I tell families that I'm going to go see their family member in custody, and I've had to been turned away, essentially, and saying I can't go see them because of the front desk of the facility.
Very illuminating, Susan. Thank you for sharing it. And as we run out of time, Jalika from The Atlantic, for all these stories that we're hearing, part of the Deputy Attorney General's statement the other day is that they don't even save substantially on costs. So if the point of using a private contractor for prisons in the first place was that it would save the taxpayers money, did they conclude that it doesn't even do that?
Yeah, they did. As a matter of fact, they did. And it's a combination of factors. You know, it's the per day cost, the per inmate cost. But I think also they're looking at the long-term impact on things like rehabilitation efforts, things like you know, the recidivism rates, things like people coming back to communities and committing crimes sometimes, or coming back to communities that are already depleted from resources and not having come back with real skills. And so there's a combination of things that add to the actual cost, not just the overhead of keeping someone in prison.
Jalika Lantigua-Williams covers criminal justice for The Atlantic. Thank you so much for helping us understand what the Justice Department did the other day, announcing that it will end the use of private prisons.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And for our last few minutes this morning, What do you do when one of those unair-conditioned subway cars comes along in the heat of the summer? Do you stay and sit, or do you go to the next car and stand? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. I bring this up because the heat wave, which practically melted all of our brains over the last few weeks, seems to have finally broken, but below ground, the temperature takes a little longer to cool off, as well New Yorkers know. Subway platforms around the city hover around 95 degrees in many cases, easily settle in the hundreds in a good number of cases, and we're never more eager for the train to arrive when it means stepping away from the sweltering platform and into a cold subway car, right? Unless, of course, the air conditioning on board is broken. Now, many of you heard this past week, WNYC transportation reporter Kate Hines did an investigative report on what are known as hot cars, subway cars where the air conditioners don't work, finding that most hot cars are on the number one and the number six lines. The New York Times also looked into it and found that there are indeed more hot cars on the tracks this summer. So the MTA says reports of hot cars have increased. The authority says it is alerted to 12 to 16 of them each day, though officials note that this is a small share of the subway's fleet of 6,300 cars. Why does it always seem like it's yours, right? So for our last few minutes, we'll just open up the phones for your hot car horror stories, or do you stay or do you go? If you stay in the sweltering gross car, is it worth it to get a seat? And what does it say about your personality, or is it just your heat tolerance? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. On your hot car horror stories, or when is it worth it to stay in the sweltering car if it means you're going to sit? And what does it say about your personality if you stay or if you go? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, and we'll take your calls right after this.